Welcome to the Occult London podcast. This is a new podcast dedicated to exploring magic, mysticism, the Kabbalah, as well as other topics. In this week's episode, we will be exploring some of the key historical figures and also ideas in the development of meditation in the Western mystery tradition. This is not going to be an exhaustive study, but rather a general overview of some of the key points, authors and teachers that have been important to myself in relation to this. If you like the podcast, please write a review and rate us on iTunes, as it will really help us to get this message out there. Also, be sure to visit our website at www.occultlondon.co.uk, where you can subscribe to the show and you can also find us on Facebook. So let's get started. So this episode, as I said, it's an introduction to meditation in the Westernist mystery tradition. It's not going to be a practical discussion. It's more just going to be giving some of the themes and historical ideas behind it. In future episodes, I will be doing more focus on practical techniques. So I wanted to start with a quote from Paul Foster Case, who is a very inspirational writer within this area. And he says, "Meditate you must, for it is not from without, but from the Hierophant within, that your initiation shall come. You are a centre of the inexhaustible treasures of the limitless substance of the presence of God." So what is meditation? So the word meditation, I mean, there's lots of different theories around this. A very common one is the word meditation stemming from the Latin, which is meditatum, which means to ponder. Not 100% sure on this, but it is obviously quite relevant in terms of thinking about pondering. In terms of defining it, I would say meditation is very much a practice where one uses a variety of techniques to train the concentration and awareness, and also to achieve a sort of stillness and mental clarity. If magic is the art and science of making changes in accordance with will, then meditation, we could say, would be the art of causing changes in consciousness in accordance with will, which is one of the quotes from an author called W.E. Butler, who is one of my main teachers from that point of view. In terms of meditation, it's been obviously used since antiquity in many different religions as a means or a path towards enlightenment or sort of self-realization. Some of the earliest records we have are from, you know, the Hindu Vedanta tradition, and it's also been credited with having all kinds of health benefits, even up until now, with regards to the whole mindfulness movement, which is not something I'm going to be talking about. But it's worth bearing it in mind. It's also one of the most important skills, I think, in terms of what you should develop as a magician when you're starting out. And obviously, later on as well, it never goes away. Meditation is very much the core practice of my own personal practice. And if you stripped away everything else, that is what I would say would be the 100% thing. Because you don't need any tools for meditation. You know, the magician can sit down and meditate, and everything you have, everything you need, is actually within you from that point of view. So we're going to start with doing a sort of history of Western style meditation. And, you know, as I said, earliest records are from the kind of Hindu Vedanta tradition, but I think humans have probably been doing this ever since we've actually existed. It's a kind of key part of our consciousness, seeking that silence, bringing the mind under control. So it's not really something I don't think anyone's ever invented. It seems to be a natural instinct within the human being to go inwards and actually try and understand our consciousness and find that inner tradition. And you can see that, you know, very much in terms of, you know, going back right to sort of Neolithic times. You can see the paintings on the walls of the caves, for instance, and also, you know, standing stones, etc., and also the use of various psychotropic plants and substances, which we've seen, you know, we've found evidence of people using those, you know, thousands of years ago. So there's always been this urge to seek altered states to either have that experience of a divine being, or, you know, to understand or to gain knowledge that we didn't have already. As I said, the earliest records are from the East, but from the Western point of view, you know, lots of scholars believe that it's probably from, you know, ancient Egypt, dynastic Egypt, probably, where the first kind of formation of more kind of Western tradition meditation as we kind of know it now probably came from that area. And Alan Richardson, he's one of my favorite authors, said in his excellent book An Inner Guide to Egypt, "To the ancient Egyptian, every aspect of their nation was a lower analog of spiritual realities. The whole being an earthly expression of the universe and the soul of man. If ancient Egypt had an upper and lower kingdom, then this division was also to be found within the psyche of the individual. If particular gods and goddesses were worshipped at particular places, then it was because this paralleled certain functions within the mind and body. The world, the universe, and the soul of man mirrored each other. Explore one, and you explored the other also." Also, we have books like the Egyptian Book of the Dead, which is almost like a meditation or a kind of guided path working in itself, in the sense that it would actually be read out to the pharaoh or important people whilst they were still alive. So it gave them this idea of being, you know, undergoing this initiatic process of dying and then being reborn in the afterlife, which in itself, as I said, it's very similar to the kind of guided visualization path working techniques that a lot of traditions within the Western esoteric schools do these days. It's not exactly sure where it would have spread from Egypt. You know, some possibility said it could have come via Alexander the Great's military campaigns in India, which is around 327 to 325 BCE, and then possibly filtered into texts such as the Corpus Hermeticum, which were part of the Egyptian Greek texts from around a second century or earlier. Just to tell you a bit about that, so the Corpus Hermetica is mainly presented as dialogues in which a teacher generally identified as Hermes teaches a pupil. So they discuss things like the divine, the nature of the mind, cosmos, and also things like alchemy, astrology, and other concepts as well. For example, from the Pymander, which is one of the first tracts of the Corpus Hermeticum, it says the following: "Upon a time, while my mind was meditating on the things that are, my thought was raised to a great height, while the physical senses of my body were held back, just as the senses of man who are heavy with sleep after a large meal or from fatigue of body. I thought I heard a being more than vast, in size beyond all bounds, called out my name and say, 'What wouldst thou hear and see? And what wouldst And what hast thou in mind to learn and know?' And I said, 'Who art thou?' He answered, 'I am shepherd of men, mind of all masterhood. I know not what thou desirest, and I am with thee everywhere.' And I replied, 'I long to learn the things that are, and comprehend their nature, and know God. This is what I desire to hear.' He answered, 'Hold in thy mind all thou wouldst know, and I will teach thee.' And with these words his aspect changed, and straightway in the twinkling of an eye all things were opened to me, and I saw a limitless vision. All things turned into light, sweet, joyous light, and I became transported as I gazed." And that's from the Pymander, which is part of the Corpus Hermeticum. Absolutely stunning and beautiful poetry within that particular text, and it's, you know, very very much worth doing some meditation upon the actual text, because you know, you can get a lot of insights from it. So moving on to the ancient Greeks, they obviously had a process of meditation, which is using kind of incubation and dreams. So the process would be they actually have these dream temples, apparently, where people would go. There would be various ceremonies, and to kind of invoke the god or goddess of the temple, people would sleep, and then they would have a dream, which would then answer their question or solve a problem that they might be having in their lives. So the god would kind of visit them in that sense. It's almost like a kind of form of meditation. Also, Plato and Aristotle, as well as the historian Herodotus, you know, kind of admit that they use the influence of the Orient upon the Greek thought. So, you know, they talk about the high virtues of the philosophical life. And they also talk about admiring the kind of sages as well, in terms of their immunity to pain and discomfort and their kind of disinterest in pleasure. And Plato says, "But when returning into herself, the soul passes into the other world, the region of purity and eternity, and immortality and unchangeableness, which are her kindred, and with them she ever lives. When she is by herself and is not let or hindered, then she ceases from her erring ways, and being in communion with the unchanging is unchanging. And this state of the soul is called wisdom. The soul is in the very likeness of the divine, and immortal, and intellectual, and uniform, and indissoluble, and unchangeable." So this is kind of talking about the this kind of state of mind, really, that one would attain through the practice of the virtue and the kind of purity of the mind, which again is quite similar to the goal of meditation in terms of clearing the mind. The Greeks were meant to have also practiced this thing called navel gazing, which is, I can't pronounce the Greek very well, but I believe it's omphaloskepsis. And that's quite interesting because obviously in yoga, the navel is the site of the manipura or nabhi chakra, which is one of the most powerful chakras in the body. And that's also where the, you know, this navel gazing was focused on. So, yeah, quite interesting from that point of view. Moving on to Neoplatonism, so Plotinus, who's the 3rd century, and he was kind of part of these philosophers. So we've got Philo of Alexandria, Plotinus. They very much kind of developed their own practice of concentration. I'm going to do an episode later on one of Plotinus's meditations, which is really interesting. But here's an example of something from him, and I'll give you a quote. "Let not only its encompassing body and the body's rating sea be quiet, but all its environment, the earth quiet and the earth sea, and the air quiet and the heaven itself at peace. Into this heaven at rest, let it imagine soul as if flowing in from outside, pouring in and entering it everywhere, and illuminating it, as the rays of the sun light up a dark cloud and make it shine and give it a golden look. So soul entering into the body of heaven gives it life and gives it immortality and wakes what lies inert." So that's really interesting, again, from the point of view of this. It's almost like a guided meditation or visualization. So moving on to more kind of Christian influences in our review. So we've obviously looked at some of the Greek and Hellenistic stuff. And from the Christian point of view, the early Christians were likely to be hermits and ascetics rather, who would probably disappear for long periods into the desert to hear messages from God. We obviously see that in you know, the Old Testament, for instance, you know, Moses, and also you know, with regards to the, you know, things like the book of Joshua, for instance. And also in the New Testament, we've got, you know, accounts of Jesus obviously distancing himself and going off for these kind of long periods of spiritual meditation and fasting, where he's meant to have kind of communicated with God. So, for instance, there's the 40 days after his baptism where he goes off and also spends, you know, time in the desert, you know, thinking about things and doing that meditation. A lot of the early meditation by the Christian mystics was basically kind of based on this repetition of a word or a mantra style. So, for example, one form of this is what is known as the Jesus Prayer, which was developed between the sort of 10th and 14th centuries, and it's also known as the Hayes Chasm Christian tradition. And historians kind of speculate that this group of Christians may have had contact with Sufis and Indians. This prayer is very much, it's a mantra style, so you just say it over and over again for hours and hours on end, and the kind of goal of it being to kind of still that monkey mind that we have, which is constantly chattering in the background, and really kind of get you into that sort of state of mind where you're completely at peace. They developed the actual technique from the Gospel of Matthew, which said, and I quote, "Be thou when thou prayest, enter into thy closet, and when thou hast shut thy door, pray to thy Father, which is in secret, and thy Father, which seeth in secret, shall reward thee openly." And the actual phrase that they're meant to have used is as follows, "Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner." So they would say that over and over and over and over again for hours and hours on end, as well as obviously doing things like fasting and, you know, lack of sleep, etc., which would obviously start to lead you into these kind of mystical states. Bishop Ignaty Bryankaninov, who was a bishop and a theologian of the Russian Orthodox Church in 1807 to 1867, he said the following about this: "The essence of the matter consists in the union of the mind with the heart during prayer, and this is achieved by the grace of God in its own time, determined by God. The breathing technique is fully replaced by the unhurried enunciation of the prayer, by a short rest or a pause at the end, each time it is said by gentle and unhurried breathing, and by the enclosure of the mind in the words of the prayer. By means of these aids, we can easily attain to a certain degree of attention." And the Bishop Ignaty also suggests, with regards to the speed of recitation, "To say the Jesus Prayer 100 times attentively and without haste, about half an hour is needed, but some ascetics require even longer. Do not say the prayers hurriedly, one immediately after another. Make a short pause after each prayer, and so help the mind concentrate. Say the prayer without pauses." So, yeah, and that's one aspect of it. The obviously within the Christian tradition, you know, things developed on from this, you know, into more sort of Bible reading within the Benedictine monks, which was called Lectio Divina or divine reading. And it had a four formal steps as a ladder, which were defined by the monk Guigo in the 12th century with Latin terms such as lectio, meditatio, oratio, and contemplatio, which is read, ponder, pray, and contemplate. Then later on in the 16th century, you have Ignatius of Loyola. So Ignatius of Loyola actually founded the Society of Jesus, or the Jesuits, and he conceived the Jesuits as being contemplatives in action. So this is basically, he developed a form of Catholic meditation and prayer, which is known as the spiritual exercises. And they are essentially like a compilation of meditations, prayers, and contemplative practices to help people kind of deepen their relationship with God and the life of Christ. And it is very much almost like imagining yourself going through the you know, through the actual passion and through different episodes in Christ's life. So you're right, it's almost, again, it's very similar to the Western mystery tradition of kind of guided meditation from the point of view of using your imagination to actually imagine yourself there, feeling the emotion, etc. Another one to mention from this period is Teresa of Avila, who's 16th century Spain. She wrote a book called The Interior Castle, which was basically a guide for spiritual development through service and prayer. She kind of had these visions of the soul as a diamond in the shape of a castle containing seven mansions, which she kind of reinterprets as a journey of faith through seven stages, which is quite interesting because obviously connects the seven with the the chakras. From that point of view, we could make a connection there. And again, very interesting to read, so worth checking out. Moving on from Christian, we move into Jewish mysticism. We've obviously spoken quite a bit on previous episodes about the Kabbalah. And obviously within the Jewish tradition, there was very much strong Kabbalistic tradition of rabbis. One in particular that is very worth mentioning is one called Abraham Abulafia, from 1240 to 1291. I'm just going to have some water. He's very interesting as a spiritual force, and he's actually still quite popular now, which is pretty incredible. So he had a lot of influence on popular culture during his time. So Dante Alighieri is meant to have been inspired by his theories of language. He also inspired poets and creatives in the Beat Generation, Philip K. Dick. Umberto Eco also mentions him in his novel Foucault's Pendulum. He was also modernized in and kind of popularized in the 60s by Rabbi Arya Kaplan. And there's also a Hollywood movie about him called we're starring Richard Gere as well, which is definitely worth watching. I've got a quote from that particular movie here, and I'll put that in the show notes. And he says, "Make yourself right, cleanse your heart and soul, permute the letters back and forth. You'll then feel as if an additional spirit is within you. In this manner, you'll reach beyond yourself. Go slowly, as the path is dangerous and must be travelled with caution." And then also this quote as well is from the movie. "God is everything, a perfect luminous essence, but even God wants more, to experience more, to give. So God creates a vessel, a container that can receive this gift of God's pure light. His divine light pours into the vessel. This vessel, of course, can't contain the magnitude of this light, and it shatters, destroying the vessel and scattering its broken shards in a bing bag of creation. Now man's job is to locate and gather these shards, to make the vessel, our world, whole again." And that is from the movie with Richard Gere, which I'm just trying to find the name. It's called Bee Season. It's not particularly about Abulafia, but he does mention him as Richard Gere in the movie is a scholar who kind of is writing about Abulafia. And then there's this whole piece about his daughter doing a spelling test, and there's the permutation of the letters. So it's worth watching. It's not particularly occult, but it's worth watching just from that point of view. Just to tell you a bit more about Abulafia, so he was born in Spain and lost his father at quite an early age of the 18. So he kind of travelled around the Mediterranean, visited Israel, Greece, Italy, and then he returned to Spain and studied Kabbalah in Barcelona with Baruch Tadami. And also taught it in Castilla. He wrote most of his manuscripts in a place called Messina, but he kind of his approach to Kabbalah and spirituality kind of obviously did create quite a lot of enemies at the time. So he kind of had to escape to a small island of Camino. His work actually formed a major inspiration in the Italian Renaissance to people like Pico della Mirandola, Raymond Lull, who was also particularly interested in him. And there's quite a lot of evidence to suggest that Raymond Lull and Abulafia probably had similar sources in Catalonia, which were preserving wisdom from Languedoc, which was a lot of Kabbalists who had crossed the Pyrenees and brought the texts, the teachings of the Book of Formation with them. Most of his work is generally focused on the Sephirot and other theosophical aspects within what he does, but he does have quite a different approach in terms of what is he focuses very much on this kind of idea of prophetic Kabbalah, and also this kind of practical approaches to getting into the states of consciousness which facilitate awareness of the divinity. For Abu Lafia, we have these seven main layers, which again is interesting because obviously we just spoke about that with Teresa Avila and the seven chambers of the interior castle. But he has seven layers which he uses to kind of analyze spiritual texts, and you do these through different approaches of meditation. The first one is permuting letters in writing, so you form different combinations between the letters and sounds that form the holy names and the vowels in a systematic manner, and then this helps you to get into this psychological state similar to a sort of flow. So you're again like a mantra, and you've got the chanting, the permutation with rhythmic breathing, and then also permutating the letters mentally while manipulating their shapes. And this, if you use these techniques, it was meant to kind of bring on this kind of union with God. So definitely worth checking him out. Moving on to the Renaissance, and there's an awful lot of stuff that we can't cover in this episode because obviously we are kind of limited on time. During the Renaissance, there's lots of different magicians, mystics, and philosophers, and you know we have a variety of them. So there's people like Gemistos, Plathon, Marsilio, Ficino, Giovanni Pico della Mirandola. Particularly with regards to the esoteric thinking in the West. There's lots of translations of older philosophical and spiritual and mystical texts taking place at the time, which were obviously inspiring lots of different Renaissance thinkers, poets and artists. One of the most prominent translators of classical texts was the Italian philosopher Marsilio Ficino. So he, during the sort of second half of the 15th century, Ficino's attempts to revive kind of Platonic and Neoplatonic philosophy become more popular around then, and he also begins to translate all of Plato's dialogues into Latin, which was something that he was kind of paid to do by Cosimo de Medici, who was the most wealthy family in Italy at the time, or certainly one of them. So these types of things would have filtered back into the kind of magical thinking of the time. Another person is worth mentioning of this period is Giordano Bruno, who was a Dominican friar, philosopher, mathematician, poet, and hermetic occultist. And he's known for his, you know, cosmological theories, particularly around the Copernican model. He also said the stars were distant suns surrounded by their own planets, and also actually had kind of early ideas about other planets containing life, which was extremely heretical, obviously, for the time. Other people it's worth mentioning from that point of view is another one that I think probably most magicians out there know is Heinrich Cornelius Agrippa. And he was based in Germany, but he was a polymath, physician, scholar, soldier, and also an occult writer and a magician of very much his own right. He had a very diverse career. He was a secret agent, soldier, and also taught law in Cologne, Paris, lived in Italy and London as well. Worked as an alchemist, which is really interesting, so it's definitely worth looking at that. And also, was very important in terms of the circles he moved in with regards to, you know, King Francis the First, as well as other kings as well. He wrote lots of different topics, including marriage, military engineering, but his most famous work is a three-volume book called De Occulta Philosophia, which is written in 1510, published in 1531. And this is very much a book which has influenced, you know, magic you know, for an awful long time since then. And this is the three books of occult philosophy, which most people who are involved in this would know about already. He doesn't really mention meditation directly in these three books, but he does bring up the idea of the imagination and the idea of it being connected. And also we can kind of read between the lines in terms of that is really what he's talking about. And this is quite well discussed by Lehrich in a book called The Language of Demons and Angels, when he says, having established that the invocation of divine names is legitimate, Agricka moves on to explain that the power of the divine names emanates downward through all the middle causes into these interior things. Because the execution of the divine will is distributed to various ministering angels and thence to the stars, but as it were by instruments, that after this manner all things might work together to serve him. Therefore the heavens receive from the angels that which they dart down, but the angels from the great name of God and Jesus, the virtue whereof is first in God, afterward diffused into these 12 and 7 angels, by whom it is extended into the 12 signs, and into the 7 planets, and consequently into all the other ministers and instruments of God, penetrating even to the very depths. If a man capable of the divine influence do make any member of his body clean and free from filthiness, then it becometh the habitual and proper seat of the secret limb of God, and of virtue to which the same manner is ascribed. These members, therefore, in God are like to ours, but the ideas and exemplars of our members, to which, if we rightly conform our members, then being translated in the same image, we are made the true sons of God, and like to God, doing and working the works of God. So the implication is clear from this, obviously, that through, you know, through meditation, ritual, invocation of the divine aspects, the magician's soul and body becomes to really reflect that higher nature of divinity. And so that's where we kind of, you know, we definitely have this idea that Agrippa was very much thinking of as above, so below, which is one of the key Hermetic axioms, that his body had to be aligned in a certain way with his mind, with his spirit, in order to draw these forces down. So moving on, we can't, as I said, we can't go through everyone in detail. There's other figures around this time. We've got people like Emanuel Swedenborg, Anton Mesmer, Paracelsus as well. But we will be going into those in other details. Another magician who kind of has quite a big influence on this is Eliphas Levi, who was born Alphonse Louis Constant. He was a French occult author and ceremonial magician, and published several books which are worth reading. We have Meditations on the Tarot, and there's also Transcendental Magic. I personally find his books a little bit heavy going, and that, you know, they are very dated, but there is some useful stuff in them, and, you know, they're definitely worth checking out if people are interested. So a lot of these ideas from this kind of Neoplatonic ideas, Eliphas Levi with the ceremonial magic, Agrippa, these all kind of come up to a boil towards the end of the 19th century. And then you get what we most people probably know of, which is the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. This was a secret society that was founded in London during the late 19th and 20th centuries, mainly focused on theurgy and spiritual development, but it influenced. And that order has influenced, I think, everybody who's involved in ceremonial magic since then, from kind of Wicca, Thelema, Aleister Crowley, etc. The order itself was founded by William Woodman, William Westcott, and also Samuel MacGregor Mathers. They were all Freemasons originally. And the order is actually kind of very similar to a Masonic order, in the sense that it was based very much on this hierarchy of titles and grades, different initiations. One of the main differences, however, was women were allowed to join the order. The Golden Dawn was one of the first of the sort of three orders, but they're all kind of collectively called the Golden Dawn. So the First Order taught more sort of esoteric philosophy, which was based on the Kabbalah and, you know, personal development through study and awareness of the four classical elements, as well as other arts, so like astrology, tarot, and geomancy as well. And you were actually given, you know, kind of exam papers and knowledge papers that you had to learn off by heart and kind of prove that you understood the knowledge before you were progressed to the next stage. The Second or Inner Order was known as the Rosaia Rubae et Aurea Crucis, which is the ruby, rose, and cross of gold. Sorry if I'm destroying the Latin there. I'm not very good at Latin. And this Second Order taught magic, scrying, astral travel, and alchemy. And then obviously there was a Third Order, which was kind of meant to be the Inner Order beyond that, which was the secret chiefs who were kind of on the inner planes. From the point of view of our discussion tonight, the Golden Dawn used lots of different techniques, which included things like, you know, rhythmic breathing. So they used different things like the fourfold breath, eightfold breath, which we'll talk about in future episodes. You know, different relaxation processes, visualization as well. So particularly on the visualization, they developed various different rituals and or used them anyway. We don't know whether they 100% developed them, but you know, you've got things like the Kabbalistic cross, there's the lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram, hexagram ritual. So these types of things were really developed and taken to another level within the Golden Dawn. There's also different use of the imagination as well, which is really interesting. So they have techniques of scrying the tattvas, which is another episode we will do in the future. Obviously the Enochian ethers, and then there is also this technique called rising on the planes. And I'll do an episode on this, but essentially what you would do, you could often use the tarot trumps, for instance, which we've done some recent episodes on. So say, for instance, you would have a tarot trump of the magician card in front of you. You'd have that on your altar. You would do various banishing rituals and purification rituals. So, for instance, you'd probably do the Kabbalistic cross, you'd do some lesser banishing rituals, the pentagram, and then you would very much kind of focus on this card, fix it into your mind so you can see it. Then you'd shut your eyes, and then you actually would project your consciousness through the card, using it as a doorway onto this other astral plane. And then once you were there, you would experience different things. You'd experience different landscapes. You'd meet different guides. And they also had a very interesting technique, sort of being able to test whether a guide was good or bad, and whether it was right or wrong. So they would use different keywords and different gestures and symbols as a way of testing whether or not what you were seeing was correct. So it was very much a kind of safe way of experiencing these other inner worlds and being able to challenge them as well. So yes, obviously moving on from that point of view, another person I can't do this episode without mentioning is obviously Aleister Crowley, who people either love or hate. He was actually a member of the Order of the Golden Dawn for a period, but fell out with them. We won't go into the details of that particular history, but just suffice to say, from the point of view of this episode, he was very much into meditation, both from a kind of Western point of view, but also through his studies within the Buddhist tradition with his friend Alan Bennett, who was also in the Golden Dawn. His technique is, you know, there's a lot of different stuff, so I'd probably recommend, if you're interested in that, to read some of his books. But it did involve lots of breathing techniques, yoga positions, and also mental exercises to train the body and the mind into a single point of focus. And he says the following about meditation, which is a quote I quite liked. "We are not to regard ourselves as base beings without whose sphere is light or God. Our minds and bodies are veils of the light within. The uninitiated is a dark star, and the great work for him is to make his veils transparent by purifying them. This purification is really simplification. It is not that the veils are dirty, but that the complexity of its folds make it opaque. The great work, therefore, consists principally in the solution of complexes. Everything in itself is perfect, but when things are muddled, they become evil. He also said, "This star or inmost light is the original individual eternal essence. The Ku is the magical garment which it weaves for itself a form, for its being beyond form, by use of which it can gain experience through self-consciousness. This Ku is the first veil, far subtler than mind or body, and truer, for its symbolic shape depends on the nature of the star." So his work is very much about, you know, this realization that there is an inner star within each being. Every man and woman is a star. And through the process of training the mind, we're able to kind of clear these veils. But it's not the same as this idea that that enlightenment is something miles and miles away. It's actually something that we have already within us, but it's just a case of almost clearing the screen so that you can actually see through, and it will actually shine through the layers. So we become almost like a crystal or a gemstone. A couple of other people I just wanted to mention before we finish. So Dion Fortune, Violet Mary Firth, 1890 to 1946. So she's been a big influence on the work I do. British occultist, ceremonial magician, novelist and author. She was the co-founder of the Fraternity of the Inner Light. And she wrote lots of different books, which are really worth reading. And as well as ideas, she wrote some novels as well. Particular books that I would recommend if you're interested in getting into her ideas are Psychic Self-Defense is definitely worth having a look at. It's very kind of straightforward ideas in that point of view, and very good for the beginner. Also, I quite enjoyed her novels as well, because you do find a lot of the meditation and magical theory brought out in her books, as well as some wonderful poetry as well. So there's books such as The Sea Priestess, The Goatfoot God. You know, they're very beautifully written and well worth reading if you're interested in her. Another person who has also influenced me greatly, and who books I cannot recommend highly enough, is W.E. Butler. 1898 to 1978. He was also an occultist and author and founder of the SOL in Britain. And his first training was with a bishop in the liberal Catholic Church who was called Robert King, who also trained him as a medium. Butler is meant to have studied in India. So he studied with some Indian mystics, and then he also met Annie Besant, who apparently he asked if he could study with her, but unfortunately she said no. So he returned to England and joined the Society of the Inner Light with Dion Fortune. There's a really great story about how he met Dion Fortune while he was I think he saw a dream, from what I remember, but he saw a woman tending some roses, and then he went to Glastonbury and he actually saw Dion Fortune in her garden at the foot of the Tor, and then that's what kind of spiraled it into working with her. And then he was also fundamental in terms of meeting Gareth Knight and developing various different courses within the Kabbalah for Helios books. His books are really, really good, and as I said, I can't recommend them highly enough. Particular ones that I found really useful are Apprentice to Magic. This is a book very much written from the perspective of a teacher to a student. So the lessons are, it begins with really kind of from nothing. So you begin with basic exercises in sort of meditation, training, visualization, power, through to more complicated things as well, complicated things and techniques, and also the Tree of Life. And then also The Magician, His Training and Work, which is a really hard book to get hold of, excuse me, these days. But it shows the reader how to go further in terms of the ritual magic and using the Western methods, as well as things like astral projection, etc. So if you can get hold of those books, I would really, really highly recommend them. So yeah, that kind of ends our session tonight. Hope everyone found it interesting. As I said, I just wanted to give you a quick overview of some of the kind of background to the Western mystery tradition meditation techniques. We'll be going into these in a lot more detail in terms of actual practical techniques that you can use to do these things safely. So yeah, hope you found this helpful. I wanted to finish the episode with a quick poem, which is actually from one of Dion Fortune's novels, which is The Sea Priestess, and it goes as follows. I am the soundless, boundless, bitter sea. All things in the end shall come to me. Mine is the kingdom of Persephone, the inner earth where the pathways three, who drinks the waters of that hidden well, shall see the things whereof he dare not tell, shall tread the shadowy path that leads to me, Diana of the ways and Hecate, Selena of the moon, Persephone. So thanks very much for joining us this week on the Occult London podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it. If anyone has any questions for me, then please reach out to me via Facebook, and I'll put the details in the show notes. Or you can also reach out to me on email, as I would love to answer any questions people have. The email address to contact is occultlondonpodcast@gmail.com. That is occultlondonpodcast@gmail.com. Also, we really want to develop this project further, so would really appreciate it if you can rate the show or leave a review on iTunes or other platforms, as this will mean more people can see it and hopefully we'll get some more value out of it. Also, please make sure to visit our website at www.occultlondon.co.uk, where you can subscribe to the show. Hope everyone's enjoyed this episode, and thanks very much for listening. Bye bye.